1 Corinthians chapter 7. We come to the chapter now. We looked a little bit last time as Paul was expressing about glorifying God through your bodies. And the body is not for immorality. And now he comes to chapter 7, which really is talking about this thing called marriage. And a lot of instruction about marriage and singleness in this chapter. Some view marriage with a rather disdain. In fact, in the latter days, Paul said that people would actually forbid marriage or make marriage less than desirable. And in some places, actually, people make celibacy more spiritual than marriage. Of course, it wasn't the case among the Jewish people. In fact, two of the worst curses on your life, number one would be to be unmarried, and two would be to be married and have no children. So that was a strong motivation because they understood marriage was good. God gave marriage to man. He saw that Adam was there alone, and it was not good that he was alone. In fact, everything God created was good until he came to man, and he said, it's not good that he's alone. And he said, I'll make a helpmate for him. And so he put him into this deep sleep and took out of his side. The Bible speaks about a rib, but it's actually a Hebrew word that implies a lot more than just the physical rib. That spiritual and physical operation that God performed, taking out that side of Adam and making into the woman, and brought the woman unto the man. Genesis 2 describes this. He made them male and female, and that describes how he did it. And then he brought the two together, and the Bible says the two became one flesh. And that is really the foundation for marriage. Marriage, in this particular chapter, Paul speaks about it from an interesting angle, but you have to realize there might be some underlying questions, especially in the Corinthian culture, and especially since he just got through talking about the problem of fornication and immorality and adultery, and which was rampant in that society. So essentially, he treats marriage in the first 9 verses as a provision against immorality. Of course, there's a much higher view of marriage that we'll look at here, but that was the main reason. And then, of course, from verse 10 through verse 16, he's going to be looking at marriage, how it ought not to lightly be dissolved, and the unique situation between what happens when one is a believer and another isn't a believer. And you've got this marriage, this deep unity, yet they might not even be on the same page spiritually. How do you deal with that? We'll be looking at that the next time. And of course, later thoughts on marriage and singleness, being content with where you're called and not seeking to, you know, in that case, you know, because of the persecutions and difficulties, if you were called as a Christian while you were single, then that's what you were. You could have been married 10 times before and divorced, but now you're a Christian, and now whatever you're called, whether married or single, that's what God has called you to. And if you're single, then you have the right to marry. If you're married, then you don't have the right to dissolve that marriage, even if your partner isn't a Christian. So a lot of these questions he's going to be answering in this particular passage. But he made them male and female. And that's really what we're looking at. Concerning marriage, Paul is going to talk again about just the aspect of it being a great thing to help people avoid some of the pitfalls of life, particularly immorality. But it's an interesting thought about marriage. What do we think of when we think of marriage? What do men look for when they get married? Why do men get married? Why do women get married? What is their thought behind that? What are their motivations? Dr. William Harding, in his book, His Needs, Her Needs, actually shows how different men and women are in their approach to marriage and what they're looking at in a marriage. In fact, comparing the top 5 things men look for in a marriage with the top 5 things women look for in a marriage reveals some interesting insights that I want to share with you right now and before we jump into this passage. First of all, the men. Top 5 things men look for in a marriage. Number 1, sexual fulfillment. That's the top thing on the list for men. Now, you shouldn't be surprised. Your mom told you, ladies, that's what men want. I mean, that shouldn't be any surprise to you. The second thing for men is recreational companionship. He wants someone to go camping with and to play with and, you know, to have someone there with him. Third thing for a man is he wants an attractive spouse. So he wants you to look like a Victoria's Secret model while baiting the hook on his camping fishing trip. And then, of course, fourthly, he's looking for domestic support, which is a nice way of saying he wants a maid, someone to clean up after him. And fifth, he's looking for admiration and praise. He wants that woman in his life to say, "You're my hero. You're so strong. You're so great. You're so handsome. You're so spiritual." You know, to satisfy his ego needs. So that's what men are actually looking for. I mean, that is the top five things: sexual fulfillment, recreational companionship, an attractive spouse, domestic support, and admiration and praise. Now the ladies. Uh-oh. Number one, she's looking for affection. Now that doesn't mean sex. That's interesting because she's looking for someone to touch and to hold and to caress, presumably while you're watching the game together. Now, guys, first of all, you know, I would think, especially since this is so important, that you guys should be writing this stuff down. You should know what a woman is looking for in a marriage. Who am I kidding? You don't even have a pen in your hand. Ask your wife. She'll give you a pen and a piece of paper and write this down. Affection, number one. She's looking for someone to hold and to, you know, be with. Second, she's looking for support and communication. You know, women are very communicative, and they're looking for someone to talk with. And sometimes what happens is men, they're very non-communicative. And they, you know, when they're little boys, they make noises like, with their cars, you know, and, you know, the sound effects. And women are chattering conversations, you know. Little girls are just going on and on and on, bubbling up, you know, sentences, and they're learning their verbal structure. And little boys are, down the road, you know, kind of a thing. And so naturally, you come together in marriage and, you know, the woman is looking forward to some good communication, and men are sometimes just making noises like, okay. So she wants that communication. It reminds me of the little boy very excited when he told his father about getting a part of the school play. And his father says, "Well, what part did you get, son?" He says, "I got the part of the husband." He says, "Great, son. Keep up the good work. Maybe next time they'll give you a speaking part." So first, she's looking for affection. Second, for communication, support and communication. Thirdly, she's looking for honest and open communication. Now, it's interesting. That sounds like two. Communication's in both of them. And the funny thing is, guys, that's the interesting thing. It is. It's a double need. This is the issue that, you know, we're so different in this respect. Men and women are so different. And that's why it's such a challenge for men to learn how to be a better communicator. And women, of course, understanding a little more about what the needs of her husband are. Fourthly, she's looking for support financially. She has this disease. It's mullitis. It's habit forming. Credit card blanche. So she's looking for someone to pay the bills. And fifthly, she's looking for someone else. Seriously, she's looking for support financially. And fifthly, she's looking for someone to maintain family commitment. Someone that's going to be there with the family and be that leader in the family. Now, it's interesting, these things. We can learn a lot about each other just from what a man, what a woman is looking for in a marriage. Now, in Paul's day, you know, there were four kinds of marriages. Four types, distinct types of marriages. First, there was the slave marriage, and it was kind of unique in that they were considered property. And when an owner of slaves acquiesced and let two of them hook up, he would still maintain the authority, and he could decide, well, they've had enough time together, I'm going to put them over here, maybe she'll have more babies with this person. And he could move things around. And naturally, as a slave, you had no rights. You had to just, whatever happened would come your way. Second, there was common law marriage. If you were living together for a year, you were considered married. That's true in some states, actually. There's common law marriage where if you're together for a period of time, you're considered married. Thirdly, a typical thing would happen. A father would sell a daughter to be a wife for a man. A man would pay for a wife. He would save up enough money to not only buy the house to provide for his wife, but to buy her. And the daughters would be sold. And of course, there wasn't really much of a romance going on. It was just a financial, contractual relationship. But of course, they would learn to love each other. And of course, if the man was good and he would treat her well, it would work out well. The final thing was among the noble class, where they actually would have a modern ceremony that actually our modern ceremonies are built on that. Their ceremonies were similar, with both families participating, the exchange of rings, the best man, the maid of honor, the veils, the bouquet of flowers, and the wedding cake. It's interesting how it goes way back to that particular style. Now, the early church had all these types of arrangements. You could be a Christian, you could be in the first as the slaves, and now how do you take your Christian understanding in that type of an arrangement where you might not even have a say-so? You're put with someone, or you're taken from someone and put with someone else. How do you respond to that? It created a new issue. Some felt that you've got this old arrangement of marriage, and now you've got this new life, and so many of the Christian men and women were thinking, well, my partner isn't saved, so why should I even hang around here? I've got a new life. We're not even on the same page. And so Paul wanted to answer that, and he does in this chapter. To this day, I still hear, and it's staggering, the many different situations. I'm still amazed how some new thing, well, some new twist on what's happened in this particular type of relationship. And a lot of people that have marriage problems, their marriage problems are often unique, and how do you apply biblical principles to them? So Paul is going to answer a lot of those issues in marriage, and he starts out by saying, now concerning the things of which you wrote to me. So he's answering some questions, and that's important to know, because if you just take his teaching as, okay, this is all he has to say on marriage, you will miss a lot of it, because Paul, in other places, in Ephesians, for example, speaks of marriage in a much higher form than what he does in this chapter. But essentially what he's doing, he's answering questions. I'm writing concerning the things you wrote to me. What did they write? We don't know what their question was. All we can do is infer it by his answer. And the answer, he says, it is good for a man to not touch a woman. What he's saying, of course, to not touch a woman, in Genesis 26, that same idiom would be referencing having sexual relations and or marriage. So what Paul is actually saying is, it's good if you don't get married. It's good. It's okay. It's not a problem. Perhaps they were thinking, you know, should we all get married? Is this a required thing? They saw how in the pagan culture marriage was disdained. In fact, just the attitude toward marriage was quite low among the Greek philosophers. They had quite a different attitude toward it. They looked at it as something that was suboptimal. In fact, because of what the philosophers would say, you could run into problems with a really nasty wife, or you can have problems educating your children, so why bother with it all? And that was their attitude. So I can think that Greek philosophy came into bear in this question. So Paul is saying, hey, it's okay not to marry. Don't think that now you've got to get married now that you're a Christian. But here's the thing. It's good if you're not married. There's nothing wrong with that. But keep a proper perspective. One of the marks of heretics, Paul says in one of his epistles in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 3, is that they would forbid to marry. That there would almost be a super spirituality attached to not marrying. And that is, of course, erroneous, because a lot of the leaders of the church, a lot of the apostles, most of the apostles were married. In fact, Paul even later says, you know, we know that Paul was single. Some infer that because he was a member of the Sanhedrin, he must have been married, because that was a requirement. But that maybe his wife left him after he did such a dramatic shift in becoming a Christian. But he refers to his own case. He says, don't I have a right to take a wife like Peter and the rest of the apostles? So Peter was married as well, and he took about his wife. Paul is actually saying, I have a right to do that too. But he also expresses that God gave him a gift of singleness. So he's expressing this, but he lets these Corinthians know it's okay to be single. However, nevertheless, verse 2, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Oh, by the way, just him adding that second phrase would have really perked up the ears of these Corinthians. Because everything was centered around the man in that culture. And Paul, what you're going to find, it's amazing to me that professors in universities today disdain Paul because of his, what they call, you know, sexist views, and that he was a male chauvinist and he didn't like women. And the funny thing is, Paul's noted distinction from the Greek culture was that he elevated women as an equal with men. That was novel. It was amazing. He said to the men, well, Peter even says, if you don't treat your wife as an equal heir of the grace of life, your prayers will be hindered. Paul says there's neither male nor female nor Jew nor Greek as far as God's concerned. There is no distinction. And of course, to the highest level, he speaks about husbands should love their wives as Jesus loved the church, who gave himself up for the church. So Paul did not have a low view of women in any case. But they say, well, didn't he restrict being a pastor to men? Didn't he say that he did not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man? That's kind of sexist. Well, is it really? Think about it for a moment. 2/3 of every ministry opportunity in the church, because 2/3 of the church is made up of women and children, 2/3 of ministry opportunities are available for women. Why would women want to intrude in that one part where men typically have to be prodded to take the leadership role, to take responsibility? You know, where are the men leaders in the nation, in the church? Sadly, AWOL. You know, largely, you know, you go in under the children's ministry and mostly women are serving. Many different ministries, women are serving. You see the women getting together and it seems like they're more in tune spiritually. And this is the problem. We need men to be raised up to be men. And of course, there's that feminization of men from the very early years. I mean, they've got their mothers at the home and their fathers are gone to work. Then they go to school, and typically in school, most of the elementary school teachers are women. And so they've been surrounded by women, and you know, they need mentors. They need men in their lives to show them how to be a man. And the last thing you want is just to acquiesce to this problem and just like let now the men sit in the church while the women get up and do all the work of the ministry. No, that should not be the case. So Paul does not have a low view of women. He is actually speaking now. He's going to elevate this, and that's why he says, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. There's an equality there. Marriage, however, he says, is important because, in this case, because of sexual immorality. Of course, this is not the only reason for marriage, but it is a true one. Now, there's a much higher purpose for marriage, but the sex drive is certainly a contributing force to bring the sexes together so that there can be that self-control, that care for each other. You know, parents, of course, and raising your children, you've got to be conscious of how powerful that drive is. We are so filled with sex. I mean, what is the average that men think about sex every 17 seconds? On average. It's a part of our makeup. God made us that way. And I don't know what the stats are for women, but I know that certainly is the bane of society in men. And so it's a needful thing that there is a proper outlet for that incredible power and drive and thrust that the Lord has given to us. So the only way to have a truly satisfying married life is to exercise some self-control, and that's what he's going to get into here. And of course, as a married person, and as a single, you have to be careful where you channel your sexual energies. But so there's the biblical purpose for marriage right here. But there are others. In Genesis 1:28, God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. So one of the reasons for marriage is for procreation. Have children. And God has instituted that family. A man and a woman coming together, they become one flesh, they have children, they have that family unit, and family unit is certainly under attack. And it's a very, very difficult thing to see so many families break up. What that does to children, the violence that ensues in young people's lives. For pleasure, as we, in Proverbs 5, verse 18 through 19, it speaks, and we read this last time, as a loving deer and a graceful doe, the husband is exhorted to let his wife's breast satisfy him, that there is a joy to be enraptured with her love. There is a pleasure factor God put in this area of sex that he intended to be fulfilled in marriage. For partnership, it's not good that man should be alone, Genesis 2:19, so we see that. But more than that, there's an interesting picture in Ephesians chapter 5. If you'll turn there with me. Marriage does something even better for us when we understand the height of it. It can't be degraded into just something that is for mere keeping yourself from immorality. Paul is answering a question, remember, that would fit with their culture. But his real thought of marriage is in Ephesians chapter 5 when he speaks about the roles of husband and wife. And he, in a sense, says in his final conclusions, This is a great mystery. He quotes Genesis, verse 31, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." He quotes Genesis 2. And then he says, this is a great mystery. A mystery? Yeah, something that wasn't that clear, that's what a mystery is in the Bible. Something that wasn't that clear in the Old Testament, but is revealed in the New Testament. And what is revealed about this arrangement of a man and a woman coming together and becoming one? This is what's revealed. I speak concerning Christ in the church. What he's saying is that as husbands are to love their wives as Jesus loved the church, and the wives are to submit unto their husbands as unto the Lord, there is that type of a relationship that Jesus has with his bride. And there will be that great marriage supper of the Lamb when we're united with him. You see, he's already purchased us with his own blood. He's paid the dowry, so to speak. We are now under contract with the Lord. If you put your trust in Jesus, now you're waiting. Just as the typical Jewish man, when he would make the arrangements, he'd sign the documents, he'd profess his love to his soon-to-be bride, then he would go away for a time to prepare a house. And typically, he would add on to his father's house, a little place where he would, you know, make that. He had to work, he had to prepare, and then on a moment's notice, he would come back and she would have to be ready. Slip into her wedding gown and go out, there would be the marriage ceremony. It was a beautiful picture. But it's a picture of Jesus, too. He proposed to us. We responded to him. He gave us the Holy Spirit as a ring, as a seal of his commitment to us. His Spirit is with us, we know. And we have the written agreement of our arrangement right here in the Word. And we're waiting for his return when he comes back. So this human relationship is just a type of a picture of a greater relationship. And what's especially interesting is that God infers there that there is an intimacy that he desires with us. You know, religion is the big killer to intimacy. Just rules and regulations and following ceremony. What kind of a relationship is that? We've been looking at that in the Sermon on the Mount. There's something much deeper there that God intended than just having a form of religion, but denying the real power, the real life, the real joy to it. Marriage is just that picture. So there is these different, and of course the final reason, not just for procreation, for pleasure, for partnership, as a picture of the church, but also as we see here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, for purity, keeping ourselves pure. That Greek word for sexual intimacy, eros, from which we get the word erotic. God made it. God designed it. But the important thing about eros to understand is that Satan can take that powerful drive, just like he does with our need for water, our need for drink, our need for food. He can pervert those, turn it into gluttony, turn it into drunkenness. He also perverts that other powerful drive, the sex drive. And he twists eros, and he does it in such a way that gives people a greater craving for more and more, and it's never enough. It's not satisfying. Only temporarily, and then now it's created a greater need for more. And you've got this treadmill that people are on, trying to find satisfaction in that area. And it can't fill them. Because God designed eros to fit nice and safe in that phileo love, that friendship love between a husband and a wife, that give and take love, that 50-50 love. But be careful, don't stop there, because people think that marriage is just 50-50. They've forgotten the foundation. The phileo, this 50-50, this give and take, this friendship love, because that's what marriage is. It's 99% friendship. The eros is the blossom that comes out of the plant of friendship. But the friendship has to be grounded in something else, and we know that word as agape, our English pronunciation of it anyway. Agape, that committed love, that I love you no matter what happens love. The I will love you till death do us part. I vow, I commit, I am yours. And this is 100%, 100%. No matter what you do, you could flake out, you could do whatever, but I am committed. That's the foundation. And that is where you grow the phileo, the good friendship love, upon which the best eros in the world, the blossom comes. Because you've got a strong foundation and you've got a great structure that's building there. So, Paul describes this and says, for sexual immorality. Let each one have his own wife and each one have his own husband. And let, notice verse 3, you see the place for intimacy here is expressed here. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her. And likewise also the wife to her husband. Now when he says and speaks about affection, it's a word that's actually the benevolence due her, that it's referring to the intimacy in sexual relations. He goes on to say, describing this, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. You see, you've given yourself to each other. Didn't you do that in your vows? I vow myself to you. Well, that's what Paul is expressing here. This is what marriage is now. You've given the authority of your body to another. But again, Paul's understanding of the balance there. It's not just the one side where the woman is given to the man, but the man is given to the woman. And then he says in verse 5, and there's this, you see, marriage is a state of mutual obligations here. It's honorable. Marriage is an honorable thing. And the bed, the Bible says, is undefiled. You know, the way you pleasure each other as a married couple is a blessing between you and your partner under God. And the best part about it is to bring the Lord in the center of it. That's something that is, you know, unfortunately the world just treats sex as such a dirty thing, and God never did. The world has perverted it, but God has created it. And it's a beautiful, wonderful thing that when you understand what God had in mind, and you can bring the Lord right in the center of that relationship as a husband and wife. You know, to pray with your husband and your wife as you partake in that intimacy. To have Jesus on your lips while you're intimate with each other is just amazing, because this is what God has designed. But he says, notice this, do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. Don't deprive one another. You see, you don't have the right, actually, if my body is my wife's and my wife's body is mine, we don't have the right to deprive each other, except by consent. We agree together. Now let's take a break. Let's take some time and just pray and give this time over to the Lord. And then come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. That lack of self-control is going to come into bear in the thought of singleness and marriage. Now, there are some who are just naturally content to not have to have intimacy or intimate relationship. They're content the way they are. They have that gift of singleness. But not all are made that way. Now, some of you might even be worried, you know, if you're single here tonight, you might even worry, I hope I don't have the gift of singleness. If you think that, you most likely don't. But if you're like, yeah, I don't really care whether I get married, I'm happy the way it is, you know, then you may have that gift of singleness. But the key is here, it's like when you are married, celibacy and singleness is expected. If you can't control yourself, then marriage is something that he would advise. It's advisable because that's the place for intimacy. But in marriage now, you can't deprive each other except by consent so that you don't lose your balance. But of course, if you're tempted, you know, you need to come back together. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. Now, what is Paul using in verse 6 to refer to? The previous verse or the previous whole point on whether or not you need to marry? He says it's good to not marry. But he's saying it's not a commandment. This isn't a commandment. This I say by permission or concession. Because of the culture, there is a certain concession there that, you know, he would love as he says it. He says, for I wish that all men were even as myself. In other words, I wish everyone had the gift of singleness. You know, of course, if all the Christians had the gift of singleness, there'd be no Christian families. So obviously, Paul knows that's not it. But he understands that in the time of distress, as he will later refer to, during great times of distress, being married can be a huge roadblock. You know, if you're persecuted and your life is on the line and they're going to come and kill you for your Christianity, it's one thing as a single to face that type of, I'm going to die for my faith. But if you have a married partner, it's a greater burden, a much greater burden. Can you imagine being separated from your family and seeing the pain they're going through? See, it's okay if you go through the pain, but to see them go through the pain. I know this sounds strange to some people. You know, my wife and I will talk about, hey, when the Lord takes us home and how that'll work out. And, who's going first, and I know she prays that I go first, and I pray that she goes first. And that sounds strange only because I don't want to go first and just leave her with the sense of that emptiness. I mean, how hard it is. And the same thing, she's thinking of me. You know, it's an interesting thing. It's like we know where we're going. That's the point. That's why it sounds strange to some people to say that. But we know the outcome of that. But how hard it is in times of persecution. Can you imagine? If you were being tortured for your faith, that's one thing. But to see your wife being tortured, you might be tempted to give it all up. If they say, hey, if you want to reject Jesus and we'll stop torturing your wife, you know, I mean, think how hard that would be. Hey, if it's just me, bring it on. But it's my wife, you see, there's a greater problem. And of course, he refers to that. So he refers, I wish all men were as myself, content to not have to get married. But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. So he refers to singleness as a gift. And it's a gift that he happened to have. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I am. It's okay. Now later in Timothy, he says he advises the young widows to marry. Here he tells the Corinthians, it's okay if you don't get married. But in the case of a young widow who, you know, after the grieving process is over, she might rashly devote herself to say, I'll never marry again. And then after time goes on, she's given this vow, and yet she's now tempted. And he says, no, he just thinks it's better. You know, she was married once, and there was that natural desire. She didn't have the gift of singleness. It's better to get married again. But he's not saying it by way of commandment. He says, but if they cannot exercise self-control, you see, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. And the translators add, with passion, just to let you understand that's what he's referring to. But the word is just, it's better to marry than burn. Some have tried to say that it's better to marry than to burn in hell. And that's, of course, ridiculous. The word simply means to burn, and it's implying the passion, to let passions dominate your life where you can't think of anything else. Better to get married if you can't control yourself. Which is, of course, the important thing about having that readiness in your heart and your mind to make that commitment. To have a need, especially in this case, that sexual desire need, there's a lot more that has to happen before you can get married. I mean, do you qualify for marriage just because you can't control yourself? I don't think so. I think there's much more to that. In fact, when you consider what husbands are called to be in order that marriage could take place, that's a tall order. Husbands, love your wives as Jesus loved the church. That's not about fulfilling your need. See, there's the amazing thing. You can't fulfill your need. This is the problem, though, in society, that too many people are self-fulfilling their needs. They're fulfilling their needs on their terms. Pornography, self-sex, fornication, all kinds of other perversions that people are stimulating and overstimulating themselves. And you know what's happening is you're not building a strong foundation in your character upon which you could truly be that husband or be that wife. You're sowing the seeds of unfaithfulness now. How then can you have that communication and that commitment? God makes these wonderful promises, not to couples, but to individuals. If you obey me, you'll be blessed. God will bless you. The idea there is that blessing comes from just the obedient state. It's a sacred responsibility to please one another and not please oneself. You know, and that's what's so unique about Paul's relationship and understanding here. The husband has no more rights than the wife. It's the revolution in that culture. I don't have the right to please myself. I don't have authority to do that. So there is that natural vulnerability that's built into a relationship. To love anyone is vulnerable. Giving your heart to somebody. Think about what you're doing. You're basically yielding your rights, in a sense, to that person to please you, and you will not please yourself. You know, men who please themselves, they're missing marriage, they're unfaithful, and I'll tell you what, they're going to have to answer before God one day. But more than that, what they're looking for, they'll never find. Because they've closed their eyes to the thing that God has provided for them. Now, how do you build that marriage? You know, he's going to be talking about marriage in the next part of this, but just thinking in terms of marriage, what is two people getting together except but by way of communion and communication? Communication is key. Couples that break down in communication, everything else breaks down. Everything else is hit. The Bible tells us that the art of communication is really the art of listening. And that, I fear, is probably one of the things that husbands fail to do the most. Might even be this week your wife said to you, "You know, you haven't listened to a word I've said." Husbands get that a lot. And they wonder why. Sure I am. What did I just say? Something about, I know, I was listening. We're not listening. And you know what? It really takes that heart to stop and listen. Second part of that is guarding your mouth. Proverbs speak about you keep your mouth, you'll keep your soul from troubles. Sometimes people can't keep their own mouth. The multitude of words, the Bible says, sin is not lacking. And then my favorite proverb, a fool speaks all that's on his mind. You got to be careful, even with people that you're very dear and near to. That doesn't mean you have a carte blanche to speak everything that you feel. There are many, many, many things better left unsaid. And if you think it's a form of being honest by speaking everything on your mind, the Bible has a word for you. You're a fool. It's not being honest at all. Some things you could say could be cruel. Some things you say could be thoughtless, insensitive, egotistical. That's why you have to check. What's coming out of my mouth? Is it edifying? Is it building up? Or is it tearing down? So many husbands tear their wives down. So many wives tear their husbands down with words. Instead of building them up, they're tearing them down. But if you could rule over your own spirit, you could rule over a city. You know, the Proverbs give so much on communication. I think it would be a great thing to read the book of Proverbs together. You would learn so much as a couple. Having a little family altar. Those couples that have that family altar and that read their Bible together and they pray together and they go to church together and they're committed in those areas spiritually before the Lord, do you know that only 1 in 1,000 of them divorce? Compared to the national average, which is about 1 in 2. 50% divorce. But listen to this. The average church member, it's about the same, 50% divorce rate. Because most people aren't committed. They're not in church regularly, praying regularly together, having that family altar, reading the Bible together, and even separately so they can grow on their own. And hence, they wonder why they're having such a difficulty. You know, marriage is like a garden. You know, it takes a plan. You need some plowing up. You know, when you first come together, there's some plowing going on. You know, you're not the same. And men and women are like cats and dogs. Their communication signals are mixed up. And it takes time to learn how to adjust to each other. Even cats and dogs can learn to get along. You need to fertilize. You need to water. You need to prune the suckers, you know, off the branches. You know, the fruit trees are growing and the sucker branches come up and they block out the light and they harbor bugs. And those things have to be cut off, things that are diverting your attention from what is most important. And then you need to wait for that fruit to ripen in its time. So Paul says, hey, you know, I wish that everyone were like myself. But, you know, that's not a commandment. That's just a concession. He says, if I say to the unmarried, to the widows, it's good for them to remain as I am. But if they can't, then it's better that they marry. See, I've heard it said, and the Greek philosophy, again, made the marriage arraignment seem less than desirable. And I've heard it said, even some people, you know, in my own hearing, saying that, well, you know, we're married, but we're not going to bring children to this world. This world is so screwed up. We decided not to have children. And you think, you know what, we have problems in this world. But all the more to raise children in the ways of the Lord, you know, I think the greater the problems in our society, the greater the opportunity. The darker the times, the more the light of a Christian will shine. So I think we need to think of it differently. We're not in this world to just have a cozy, easy life. We're in this world as trainers, being trained and being grounded and being equipped. And we're testing. Everything is being tested in us. How we love each other is going to be tested by the most unlovable people around. How we deny ourselves is going to be tested by all the selfish people around us. See, those are things that this evil in the society is just a testing ground for us that we can grow thereby and learn. Because when you finally come through those tests, there's nothing sweeter than that peaceful fruit of righteousness. After having gone through discipline even, and training and correction. But when you yield to sin, when you give yourself over to sin, you know, if you're a single, or even if you're married, and you're fantasizing and you're involving yourself in lustful thinking, and you're only going to feel that guilt, that weight, that shame. And then more than that, you're going to create a habit. If you're single, you're going to create a habit that even after marriage, it's going to be hard to escape. It's going to be much easier to go into your own little shell and meet your own personal needs than it is to learn how to be what God has called you to be for your partner, to give yourself away so that you can trust God to fulfill you. You have to understand the consequences of immorality and understand all of these things coming together. So Paul expresses this in a very tangible way in regard to a question they had. Well, you know, is it okay to marry? Is it okay not to marry? He says it's good not to marry. Later you're going to find he says it's okay to marry. Both of them. But the key is, more than anything, how we are relating before the Lord. In verse 10, he's going to turn that heat up a little bit on, "Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord." So he's going to now turn from that which is, you're free to marry or not marry. There's no commandment either way, to, now let's talk about where the commandment lies. When you're married, you know, and the Lord has put you together, then you're not to depart. And we'll be talking about that. However, he adds something to what Jesus said. He adds one more unique thing, because the condition when Jesus was there wasn't existing. And that is, what about this unique relationship between an unbeliever and a believer? And we'll be looking at that next time. I want to spend a little time in that, because that is a big concern. And then also look a little bit farther into marriage, and hopefully in a few sessions we'll have a handle on this. But we need to also bring some other passages in to get the full picture of marriage. More than anything, I pray that we would learn something about God in the challenge He's put before us. You may not have the best marriage. If you're married, you may not have the best marriage. But if you're not fulfilled as a person, and you're thinking that the marriage is the cause of it, you're greatly mistaken. God promises His promises to individuals, not to couples. There's not a contingency clause saying you can never be happy unless your husband or your wife is all that they should be. They may never be all that they should be. They may be far from that. I got news for you, good news. You honor the Lord with your part. You honor the Lord with your part. Get your eyes off of what your partner's supposed to be. See, because even in teaching on marriage, you know, generally there's going to be a percentage of people who are not even hearing anything that relates to what they're doing. They're just thinking, they're taking notes in their mind what they expect their husband to do now or what they expect their wife to do. And by the very fact of that, you've missed the whole point. It's about what God has called you to do. He will honor your obedience to Him when you trust Him with your life. And you trust Him with your sexual energy. And you trust Him that He made you. He knows what best you'll be fulfilled in. And why not channel all of that energy into something that is truly obedient to the Lord, believing in His time He will bring that to fruition? It makes sense in the rest of the world. Why wouldn't it make sense in that area? Take a guy who's going to put a garden together. And he just thinks, you know, it's a lot easier just, I'm going to throw those seeds out in the yard and walk back into the house and watch TV. And that's how people approach marriage. And they come out and they're surprised there's no fruit. But then the other person, you know, he channels that energy instead of being selfish and just, you know, indulging himself in pleasures. He is going to plow that ground up. He is going to plant that seed in rows. He's going to water it and fertilize it. And he's going to tend to the weeds as they come up. And then he is going to have a bountiful, fruitful garden. You want bountiful fruit in marriage? It takes some self-denial, just like anything else in this world. Why should it be any different? You're not going to have a good job by just showing up for work and sitting there and tapping your pencil on your desk and hanging out. You're going to need to be diligent, and then you'll be successful. Same thing in marriage. Hard part about marriage is you think that it's all dependent on the response of your partner. It's not. Let your partner be as unresponsive as anything. And for 30 days, if you're a wife, treat your husband like a king. Even if he's 100% USDA prime beef jerky. Treat him like a king. Treat him as if it was Jesus in the home. I mean, just treat him as submitting unto him as unto the Lord, caring for him, putting your life before him, and just treat him like a king and just see what might happen. If your wife is really at odds with you, maybe doesn't want anything to do with you. And, you know, sometimes I see these guys, you know, they come to the church and, you know, they're screaming at their wife, you know, they're tearing them apart, and they pull into the parking lot of the church. Hey, praise the Lord, how you doing? And their wife's all red-faced like they just been in this argument. And he can just turn on the old plastic, you know, hey, everything's fine. And you know what? If that's your case, you know what? Go back and treat your wife like a queen. You know, the simplicity of marriage is amazing. If you treat your wife like a queen, she'll treat you like a king. And vice versa. But be committed. Do it for 30 days. See what happens. Why not? You'd put that much energy in your job, wouldn't you? Give it 30 days. Don't they have like 30, 60, 90-day probation job, you know, thing? You're on your best behavior for those first 30 days in the job. You do that for work, don't you? Well, why wouldn't you do that for your marriage? Except you got that big thing of pride hanging out there. I'm not going to let them get away with what they've been doing. I don't want to even throw up on that one, so I'm going to just end while I'm right there. That's, you know what? That's our problem. It's self-centeredness. And that's why you never enter into that fullness of joy. Because self is on the throne. As long as self's on the throne, you'll never experience the abundance that the Lord had intended. You got to be willing to turn from self. Be willing to deny yourself. And when you give your life away, Jesus said, then you'll find it.